Well, this month, Wisconsin has continued to see big day-to-day swings in temperatures, high winds, rain, even snow flurries. Larry Mueller here. The weather guys are back with us and ready to answer your questions about the wild arrival of spring. John Martin isn't quite here yet. He is an associate professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, but Steve Ackerman is.
I'm happy to be here. And enthused about John coming, too.
Steve's the former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW and emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So great to have Steve with us. John will soon be here. But as we talk with Steve for the moment, how are you responding to the ups and downs of the weather lately? Do you want some recommendations for maybe better weather apps to have on your phone? Give us a call. Regardless, the number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Well, I want to start with the eclipse because you're an eclipse professional, kind of getting to be one anyway. And there's some weather connected with it that we can talk about as well. But you were there for...
I went to the one in Arkansas. That was my third one. I've seen one in Wyoming and then one in North Dakota as well. And in all three cases, it was clear. So I was lucky for that, to be able to see it. But then also to experience some of the weather changes that we would expect to see during a total eclipse.
Yeah, it's... You know, this a dramatic change happens, does it not, in the weather?
Yeah, so in some perspectives, like temperature. Temperature can drop 10 degrees. And it seems surprising that it could go that much, because when you're seeing a total eclipse, even when it's 95, 96%, it's still really bright. You can't look at it with your eyes without, you know, squinting and getting hurt. But during that time, you're getting less solar energy. And so it is slowly cooling down. And by the time it goes total, you know, it's like an overcast day, even worse, because there's even less sunlight getting down to the surface than on a cloudy day. And then that decouples the upper atmosphere from the lower atmosphere. And so often it also gets calmer as well. Sort of like it happens in the early evening when the sun first goes down.
So do you get an increase in humidity then, too?
So the relative humidity will go up because the water content in the atmosphere doesn't change in terms of how many molecules. But the relative humidity is directly tied to the temperature. And so if the temperature drops and the water doesn't change, the relative humidity automatically goes up.
Yeah. And that wind speed business, you know, it's something that we all experience. You know, somebody who does a lot of fishing or has done a lot of fishing, you know, when it gets dark, you know, as darkness comes, the wind tends to die down.
Yeah. And that's because the way that I think of it is during the daylight hours, when the sun is up, you're heating the surface. The air near the surface gets heated and hot air rises. And so when that hot air rises, there is air from above that comes down to replace it. And that air up above is often windier. And so you have a turbulence that generates the wind during the daytime. And then when the sun goes down, you no longer have that heating of the surface. You have that decoupling between the surface layer of the atmosphere and the layers above. And that causes the wind to calm.
It's a pretty cool experience. I always, as a musky fisherman, I always like that because I like to use topwater baits. And when it's just fun, you can use them when it's wavy, I guess, but it's more fun to have one of those Phillips creepers just sort of creeping along the top of the water and then having a fish come up and grab it.
I used to do a lot of fly fishing, and it was the same thing when you had that nice, calm lake. It's just so beautiful to cast that fly and just sits on the surface. It just looks so pretty.
Oh, man. I love it for sure. Well, last May was the fourth driest on record in Wisconsin. Averaged a little more than an inch and a half of precipitation fell statewide last May. How likely is it we'll see another exceptionally dry month of May?
Hard to say. The general outlook is for cooler temperatures because El Nino is still in play. And usually that means it's going to be cooler and drier in our area. But in the May time, you know, is when we get a lot of convections, like we've been getting the last couple of days. And so you can have one convective storm and get over an inch of precipitation just from that one storm. So it really will be a function of, what is the convective situation?
We had, we get some mail relating to the show, and we got a letter from Douglas, who's in Red Granite, and wonders, had a question about accurate predictions. And he says, given that median scores are more stable than mean scores, median versus mean, would the use of median scores yield more accurate prediction when crunching weather data? And has that comparison ever been run?
I'm sure the comparison has been run. And what I'm thinking of here is the difference between the mean and the median. The mean is the average. So you take whatever the set of numbers is. Let's do temperature because it's easier for the word to say. You take all the temperatures for the month and divide it by the number of observations you have. And that's the average or the mean. The median is you find that value where 50% of the values are below and 50% are above. And so if you have a situation like temperature or a distribution that's normally distributed, like the classic bell curve, then the mean and the median are pretty much the same. So I don't think it will have much of an impact on forecasts for like temperature to see how well you're doing. If the distribution is really diverse, like trying to predict when the lake's going to freeze, that data is all over the place. And that's why when you hear the state climatologists get on and talk about the median date in which the lakes freeze, they won't talk about the mean. They'll talk about the median. And there's an example where, again, if you're going to look at what the forecast is going to be, you want to compare it to the median. So I think it depends on what the variable is in your prediction score.
Interesting. A caller who couldn't stay with us wanted to better understand the strange change in the light and air during an eclipse. We kind of talked about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it does change. It is eerie. It's different than what we get at nighttime. You know, so I was just making the comparison to the temperature drops to a fully cloudy day. But in a solar eclipse, you don't have clouds. So you do have light coming from those areas that are not in total eclipse, being scattered by the molecules in the air. And so it kind of gives you an eerie feeling that's different than sunrise or sunset. Because those areas, you know, it was around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I think, you know, so they're still having a lot of solar light being scattered by the atmospheres around us, not just in where the total blockage of the sun is.
Were you out in the open again? I remember last time you went, you talked about watching the darkness across the landscape.
Yeah, those first two times in North Dakota and Wyoming, it was flat. In Arkansas, it was also pretty open, but there were enough hills that I couldn't see the Terminator come at us. So even though I was telling everybody around, you know, with us, there was about half a dozen of us saying, oh, it's going to be so cool with the Terminator. You couldn't really see it. All of a sudden, boom, it got dark. And that was disappointing.
But. And everybody said, Steve, what were you talking
right,
about?
Right, yeah, exactly. Just looking at me. Right?
What's wrong with you anyway? But it's still
phenomenal. It is really just an experience. And now we're not going to have one for a long time in the U.S.
When's the next one?
Oh, I think at least 10, 20 years or something. Something. Yeah, I know, right?
Well, I didn't notice very much of it this time around. I was actually in a meeting, but fortunately I was in a meeting in Madison where we had windows on two-thirds of the you know.
Ah, so you can look out the window. And
look out the window, but that is not. And, you know, I could barely, you know, it got a little darker.
Yeah, it's. Once you see a total one, it's really spoiling.
It's spoiling. I got to believe that for sure. Steve Ackerman, our guest today. Steve is the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW. Of course, also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, talking weather and climate with him. And John Martin will be joining us, too, in a matter of a minute or two, a professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. We talk climate and weather, and they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio, and we'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Taking a look at weather and climate on the program today with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, one of our guests, the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW and an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin joining us too, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And John, I got to say hello to you too.
Yeah, same to you, Larry. It's good to see you.
So what do you want to know about meteorologists' forecast visibility? Are you wondering how hot this summer is going to be? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin, in Eau Claire County, up with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Vern.
Hi. I'm going to give you a comment first. Water vapor is the number one greenhouse gas, okay? So it's going to take probably till you're on next time to research this. Well, what is the effect of the Hunga Tonga volcanic eruption? That was on 15 January 2022, and it sent hot water 36 miles high. It was in the teragrams. You know, something like 140 billion tons. Plus, it sent sulfur dioxide, 400,000 tons, like 90,000 feet, plus ash, and plus CO2. So that's going to be a long-term thing. You're probably going to have to take time to research it. The other thing I got to say, and I'll give you a title because it's going to take time for you guys to look this up if you can find it. Aviation's Dirty Secret, : airplane contrails and are a surprising potent greenhouse cause of global warming. You know, a lot of this comes out of Germany. By Katie, K-A-T-I-E, Camero, C-A-M-E-R-O. It's June 28th, 2019. So it's going to take time for you guys to research this, so I don't expect you to have a close answer, but you can do as best you can on this volcanic, because this is the biggest eruption, I think, in like 100,000 years.
Okay, John, you want to start? Or
yeah. Well, I'll start with one comment. I think it's going to lead into Steve's. You know, you're right to point out that water vapor is a very potent greenhouse gas, no question about it. And adding water vapor to the atmosphere, if it weren't removed on a regular basis and systematically, would be very, very dangerous for the climate in the very near term. But we recycle the amount of water vapor that's currently in the atmosphere is 5 million billion tons or something like that, enough to cover the surface of the Earth with 1 inch of rain if it all came out right now. We recycle that 40 times a year. So a water vapor molecule does not reside in the atmosphere on average for more than 9 days. So it doesn't have too much time to do its dirty work in terms of the climate, unlike carbon dioxide and methane and some of these other gases that, as you pointed out, are long-lasting. So that's one thing. And I think the stuff about the volcano, Steve's an expert on some of those aspects.
Yeah, and what comes to my mind is, as an example, more modern-day one, is Pinatubo. Mm. So Pinatubo was another really explosive volcano. It set off a lot of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, into the stratosphere, where it can stay for a while. And it turned into sulfuric acid droplets. And what they do up in the stratosphere, very stable. They could stay around for a year and reflect solar energy back out to space. And that was in 1992, I believe.
Yeah, 91, 92.
Right, yeah. And that caused the cooling. And in fact, it perturbed the climate record so much that we were about to get statistically able to say, yes, human impact has been affecting the climate.
Oh,
Pinatubo
yeah.
went off, and it was like, now we got to wait until this natural phenomenon goes away to get back on track.
That's true. Wasn't that one of the first IPCC report eras? That's right, because the second one in 95 is the one that's often referred to, but not the first one from 5 years
And the first
earlier one
was because of Pinatubo.
How do you like that? I didn't know
that. Statistically, and again, it's back to what we do with regard to using statistics, using data, and using scientific analysis to try and keep away from any of the biases that we sometimes held as human beings.
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, now, what about the contrails?
So the thing about contrails is, in theory, they could cause a cooling. Sometimes they'll spread out through a thin cirrus shield, but a lot of times the aerial coverage isn't that big. So globally, they would have a much less of an impact than, say, around an airport or the tracks on which these high aircraft jets fly in.
Yeah.
And contrails are water vapor, right? Aren't they? Or what are
ice crystals?
Ice crystals. But it's a form of water, yeah. So it's ice. Yeah.
And they're just what occurs just like on a winter day when we breathe. We get a little condensation, except it's occurring at a much colder temperature, so we get ice crystals.
And it depends on the available water vapor, which is highly variable from one place to the next, so that, you know, they don't, every time you have a jet engine going off at those high elevations, you don't leave the same contrail because it's not the same water vapor environment.
Yeah.
So
the statewide average temperature in May of 2023 was 57 degrees. That's 1.5 degrees warmer than normal. Is climate change being felt seasonally in Wisconsin?
I wish I knew right off the top of my head in terms of that. The change that we're talking about is a global change. And so there's all kinds of variability regionally around that global change. I think it's fair to say that there are more frequent extreme precipitation events in the current day than there were 100 or so years ago. I don't know about, I think the average temperature has crept up several degrees in many of the, especially the warm season months, I think is probably right. And then the winter doesn't last as long. The ice on Lake Mendota does not last, doesn't come on as early, doesn't come off as late. Those are all things that are very definitely tied to the global change that is occurring on Earth. So, yeah, I'd say it's there's many different ways in which it's had an obvious and discernible impact.
And I think in the wintertime, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's also true, yeah.
There's the Wiki report that came out that looked at that. The Wisconsin Center for Climate...
Yeah.
Wisconsin Initiative for Climate...
For Climate Change Impacts,
right,
yeah.
So I wanted to bring up weather apps. I've got a couple on my...
Only a couple?
Well, three or four, maybe. Most smartphones come with pre-installed weather apps, which I've got. Those apps, they typically provide current weather conditions and forecasts for the next few days. How reliable are those apps in your mind?
So I have like 12 apps.
Well, he's retired. He has more time now.
I have at least three radar apps, and each one is a little different. One is the individual radars, what they're seeing, and then one is from the National Weather Service where they blend them together, and then another one, you know, kind of integrates them and does a forecast. So in general, at least the ones that I have are really good apps. They're easy to use, and that's why I have them on. I think the other important thing to remember is that if you're buying one, and sometimes you would do that to get some extra service, but the data they're using is free. It's freely provided by the National Weather Service.
Yeah.
It's paid for by our tax dollars, and that is really critical to me.
Me too. And so I kind of laugh a little bit when people compare what, you know, the quality of the app is, it's really a matter of ease of use and what are some of the dimensions, but the data is all paid for by your taxes already. And that's rare. I think in the United Kingdom, I think you have to pay extra for various other parts of what ECMWF provides. You don't have to do that in the United States.
Yeah. And that's frustrating, particularly for radar data, right?
Yeah, right.
You want to know if it's raining around you. That's the only way really to tell.
And I think that's the one that's most universally better understood by the average person today than it was 20 years ago. And it's a great service to the public to have that available.
Yeah.
And meteorologists who have their own business, they can fiddle with the data or, you know, zoom in, let's say, on data for, like, maybe their clients are farmers or maybe they're some other type of business.
Yeah, there's room for that kind of niche filling because the Weather Service's mandate is not to make site-specific forecasts for businesses or for farm interests. They give a broad thing for the broadest segment of the community. And so using information that's provided by the National Meteorological Center, private businesses can fill in some of those gaps at a cost to say, you know, I don't want to say the wrong company. Is it Chrysler down there at Belvedere? Or I don't know which assembly they do. But anyway, they need to know, get things off the lot if there's going to be a hailstorm, because that it does a huge amount of damage to their bottom line. And the Weather Service does not have the purview to make that call for them. So they have to pay someone else to do it.
Well, I know it works locally, too, because I had somebody from a car dealership say that they lost.
Yeah. Oh, man.
They had all their cars out, and a big hailstorm here hit at end of Madison, and all of those cars were just dented. Yeah.
Remember that now. And all of a sudden, there was a good sale.
It's a great deal. Nobody hits a perfectly smooth golf ball. Larry knows that. The dimples matter.
Dean in Colorado has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Good morning, folks. Or good afternoon out your way. We had another snowstorm. I think we had Wisconsin's total of 8 inches for your annual sum this year, just this weekend. But we're recuperating. Anyway, my question is actually ties in a few callers here. How conservative do you think relative humidity is globally? And the reason why I'm asking that is as global temperatures increase, the water holding capability, saturation, vapor pressure is increasing exponentially, but humidification of the atmosphere is going on as well. And I was wondering if that's keeping up. So in other words, is the average global relative humidity dropping or staying the same? What do you think?
Yeah, I should know this off the top of my head, but I'm going to struggle to figure out to get the right answer. There isn't a right answer. There is a right answer out there. I think the global average relative humidity has not changed. And what instead has changed is the amount of water vapor in the air. And what is it? What's the ratio? Is it every 7% for a degree Kelvin of global warming, I think, the relative humidity goes up or something like that?
Sounds about right, yeah.
And or water vapor content goes up to meet that demand. And I can't recall if the global average RH has changed or if it's the global average mixing ratio, the amount of water vapor that's changed a little bit, because I thought the RH had stayed the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And that strikes me as maybe more my intuition, because we 3/4 of the planet's surface is covered by liquid water. So if you warm the temperature, you're just going to have more capacity, as you point out, and it's going to come from someplace because we have vast reservoirs. So I don't think you can really starve the atmosphere of water vapor under transformed conditions where it's a little bit warmer.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Dean. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So meteorologists forecast the chance of rain in percentages. We got a question. How's the likelihood of precipitation calculated?
I think they're the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And they look at, so the National Weather Service, when it forecasts it, will look at, in the forecast area, what's the chance of there being rain, and then what area of that forecast area is covered by that rain.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a two mixtures of those calculations. I think the way that I like to explain it is the way that you explain it, that if it's a 80% chance of rain, then it means that if we had 100 days exactly like today, it would rain on any of those.
Yeah, so it's a probability of these conditions will lead to precipitation. How often?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I think that's why it's important to have a radar app.
I agree.
Because if it's going to be an 80% chance of rain in Madison, you can be sure I'm checking that radar map anytime I'm going outside.
Yeah, that's right. And the county warning areas, they're called for the Weather Service. They're not, you know, huge, but they're not small. They're not your backyard. So if somebody says there's a 90% chance of rain and it doesn't rain in your backyard, they were probably still right for the job they're trying to do. And you're right, to supplement it with a real observation, which is the radar, you can say, oh, yeah, it looks like it's raining in Dodgeville, but not here. I don't have to worry.
Yeah.
You know.
So another climate question, what is the likelihood of, you know, assuming a progression and we don't beat climate change and it progresses, what is it going to look like in Europe versus maybe here? What are the calculations or the percentages that we see?
In terms of the temperature changes and precipitation and all that? Yeah, that's a broad question. I don't know all the detailed answer to that. I think there are some places that start to show up as climate havens. They're beginning to be called by some people. I think we're one of them, actually, because the winter is going to be moderated a little bit. And the summertime is going to be, you know, not horribly warm and dry and hot. It's going to, because we get enough rain in the summertime that we don't get those horrible heat waves they can get in the Southwest. So things like that are beginning to enter the consciousness of people as they ask exactly that kind of question, but try to put, you know, again, a background global change and trying to figure out how that's going to project regionally is not always very easy.
Yeah. So, I you know, you read so many different things. I heard or was reading somewhere that Northern Europe was going to be a lot colder.
Well, I think that might have come from one of these recent discussions about will the so-called thermohaline circulation in the North Atlantic break down. If it breaks down, and there's some reasons to believe it, you know, this warming could exacerbate that probability, then that would mean that the Gulf Stream does not head toward Northwest Europe with anywhere near the vigor it has for centuries, and that would change the climate there, for sure, toward the colder side.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting, that coupling between how the ocean helps determine what our climate is.
Yeah, right. It's very.
It's not just all the water, 70% of the globally covered water.
It's moving around.
The currents,
too. Yeah, exactly right.
So another emailer wondered about your research. What are you guys looking at here at the UW first, and then nationally, maybe internationally in terms of research?
You want to go?
I'm retired, so my research is, how do you put a glass-bottom cloth on my wooden boat to give it some strength?
There you go. Yeah, I'm thinking
I'm still working with NASA on some of their satellite stuff.
I'm thinking about other problems.
That's right.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking about the interannual and long-term variability of the Pacific, not only Pacific jet now, the jet both in the Northern Hemisphere and in the Southern Hemisphere. We've recently figured out that the jet streams at the tropopause level, about 9 kilometers or so, 5.5 miles above the ground, there's a double jet stream structure in the cold season in the Northern Hemisphere, but it turns into a single jet stream structure in the right after the end of April. April's the transition month in the way that we've been investigating this, and that will vary from year to year. But when you get to May through October, you're talking about a single jet, and that is a brand new insight about the nature of the circulation in the Northern Hemisphere. So this summer, we're going to be looking at the warm season in the Southern Hemisphere. I have a suspicion it's not the same down there. And that would, of course, prompt lots of new questions. We got to figure out why. If it isn't the same, why is it different?
And so, is that because of water? The amount of water or the...
I don't know. And that's what I'm guessing. There's less continentality. And I think that makes a difference. I do think that makes a difference. Yep. So we'll see if that's right.
So how do we use those data? I mean, let's say, you know, findings of this sort. How are they used?
That's hard to know. In fact, I think any scientist who always knows what his or her current results are going to lead to is one of those lucky people. I never feel that way. I feel like all I'm doing is trying to solve this problem, which has interested me. And very often, there are downstream benefits from having spent some time thinking about it. On this one, I don't know. I think this one might tell us something about, once we know where the jet is and how it behaves throughout the year, we can say something about whether or not it's gotten wavier in the warming era, and whether or not that waviness tells us something about how the circulation around the whole hemisphere has changed and is likely to continue to change in the face of some of the circumstances that have been brought about by the warming. So there may be those kinds of long-term consequences to better understanding where is the jet and what does it do at various times of the year at the tropopause. Because I think people who have been studying that have not been studying it from the perspective of someone who looks at weather maps every day, and that makes a difference.
And
so,
and the jet stream really is important to our daily weather as well.
It
and
sure
so
is.
If you lead to that understanding, I think it also will generally lead to an improvement in the weather forecasting.
I think so, or at least weather understanding. And very often, weather understanding leads to benefits in forecasting.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe not the the next day forecast, but maybe the 5-day forecast.
Yeah, that, right. Getting into longer term. That's a very good point. Thanks.
Where are we at seven-day forecast? What's our reasonable expectation if we see it's going to rain in 7 days in wherever?
I think it depends a little bit on the season. In the cold season, I'd say that's a 70%-ish probability of being right. Yeah. So in the same way we talked about just a minute ago, 7 times out of 10 presented with the same kind of prospects, you're going to find them right. And I think also one has to qualify that by saying that, it's painting the complexion of the day accurately at 7 days. That's useful. I don't think the details are nailed down. Mm-hmm. But that's really valuable. If you can vigilantly pay attention to the weather a week in advance and say, yeah, it's going to be super cold next week, that's painting the complexion the right way, or it's going to be super humid or something like that. But in the summertime, maybe you have a little bit of a degradation at the 7-day interval. It might be only 5 days where you can feel that same kind of confidence.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that we're getting good at 5 and 6 days is why so many people have apps on their phone.
Yep, exactly right.
Because they may be with somebody and start talking about when they're going to get together next, and so they look and see what the weather map is.
Exactly. And I think it explains some of the myopia, too, of the fact that you guys used to be better at this 30 years ago. No. You're totally wrong.
Right.
We said that the other day. The idea is that you used to demand of us correctly, we want a 3-day forecast that's accurate. Well, we can give it to you at 70% accuracy 35 years ago. Now we can give you 7 days at 70% accuracy, and you're forgetting that the 3-day is now 100% accurate or close to it. So we haven't left those solved problems behind. We're going on to new challenges, and you're forgetting that.
But 30 days out, we're never going to get that 70%, are we?
There's people who don't think that. There's people who think we might. So
I mean, clearly we're looking at, it's going to be warmer than normal and things like that. And that's pretty good. But to get pinpointed, I think, again, I think it depends on what your philosophy is about the ability to determine what the atmosphere, the deterministic capability.
Yeah. And I think, to make a date-specific forecast, like for a wedding 3 months in advance, will it rain? Can I plan my thing outside? I don't see that happening at any time in my lifetime or maybe the next generation's lifetime.
Yeah.
I think that's probably way out of line.
Yeah.
Well.
But get married anyway. So.
Yeah. It shouldn't discourage you from planning your event.
Just
that's a very good
point,
Steve. That's a very good point.
on that happy note, thanks, guys. Oh, it's always a pleasure. Next time we have to talk about seeding of aluminum in the air and how it affects our weather, the environment, and our soil. So hang on to that thought.
You bet.
We didn't get to that one, but we will next time round with Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys from the UW Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, UW-Madison. Great to have them with us. And they'll be back the last Monday of next month. Great to have Jennifer Cheverini come by tomorrow to talk about her latest novel. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.